Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show, Saturday, July 25th, 2009. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic for today is the following. Behind Obama's Tiergarten Fear, that is the T4 Nazi Health Board proposal, he calls reform. Physicians are exposing the Wenberg-Dartmouth Atlas hoax. Now, the reason I'm referring to this long title in specific is we've had, it's twofold. President Obama, on July 22nd, this past Wednesday, gave a nationwide televised address in which many times over he called for a cost-saving measure of setting up a board he calls independent of Congress and political accountability so that scarce resources in terms of care can be rationed, that is, can be cut where this board of so-called experts, doctors and others, would think necessary. 1 week earlier, that's about July 16th, 17th, the White House czar for this kind of thing named Peter Orszag codified this proposal in the form of a proposed agency to be set up by Congress to function independently and decide who gets who care and who doesn't. It's called, I think, an Independent Medicare Advisory Council. So this is a very live proposal. That's one thing. It is in the character of what in September 1939 was set up by Hitler as some agency to function at a certain address. It was Tiergarten 4, to decide what defectives or undesirables or too costly elements of the population would no longer get care and eventually led right to the death camps. Now, there has been ludicrous, what you could call scientific defense of this. It isn't scientific at all. It's a life and death issue. But there's been a kind of Nazi doctor research unit established up in New Hampshire at Dartmouth College there. It was codified in 1988, and they've put out monstrous kind of defenses of why you should make these kinds of cuts so that you don't have what they call overutilization of healthcare resources. As I say, it would be funny if it weren't so deadly. Now, this is why we've invited, and I'm glad to welcome our physician friend of Mr. LaRouche and ours, Dr. Ned Rosinski, is with me here in the studio. Welcome, Ned.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
And Ned has just finished a paper that will be posted within hours on Executive Intelligence Review online, that is LaRouchePub.com, where you're listening to us today. It will be in the next issue of the Executive Intelligence Review. I think, Ned, it's, with illustrations, it's about 18 pages long. And he takes this whole business apart. He will be speaking today with us for the full hour. But for the first half hour, I'm very glad to welcome from Texas, Keisha Rogers. Hi, Keisha.
Hi, Marcia. How are you?
Good. Who's been on many times before. She's a leader in the Democratic Party of Texas and, in fact, the country and the western states, and a leader of the LaRouche Youth Movement of the LaRouche Political Action Committee that's leading the charge against what I've been describing. In fact, Mr. LaRouche, after hearing President Obama call for this kind of Nazi board on Wednesday, July 22nd, said, look, this particular demand of the president means that it's an offense that makes him impeachable. This is an impeachable offense. This isn't bad policy. This isn't unfortunate. This isn't, and that's the way it has to be looked at. So this is very hard words, but that's what is necessary. And people can look for that on the LaRouche Political Action Committee website. You know, it's LaRouchePAC.com. And also there, I want to call your attention to August 1st. That'll be a week from now on Saturday, beginning at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. Mr. LaRouche will give a live internationally interactive webcast on LaRouchePAC.com. And so, therefore, we will be carrying that, or we will be referring everyone to that instead of our usual talk show here on that we have every Saturday. Now, the other thing I refer people to is that this fight that we're now in, and Ned's going to lead off by describing this crazy so-called defense document of why we should cut health care. But it's coming at a certain time in history. We have had the crash of the financial system, a physical breakdown process. You see it in the form of the new novel flu, swine flu, as they call it. There are other diseases on the rise. You know the situation with unemployment. And in fact, most of the states, when it came to the end of their fiscal year on June 30th, couldn't even put together the pretense of a budget. Their revenue is collapsing so fast, we have a governmental breakdown. So LaRouche is pointing us to, in fact, the federal fiscal year end, which is September 30th, so count on it. By the first 10 days of October, traditionally when you're supposed to close the books and report how you did, there won't even be a pretense left anymore. We are looking to the all-out endgame blowout. So with that, Ned, let me turn to you. You've done this refutation of this crazy study. You can give us its description that Mr. Obama, the president in particular, Senator Baucus, everybody else for months has been referring to as the Bible for how you have to cut care. Go ahead.
Well, the first thing I want to say is that although I have done a refutation, a lot of my refutation has to do with refutations that have already been done. There have been attacks on this from the cancer research community, from the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiologists. There are attacks from a wide variety of public health organizations that say this Wenberg approach.
Now, he's the professor. Tell us again. John Wenberg?
John Wenberg is a physician at Dartmouth who is founded this Dartmouth project and produces this atlas called the Dartmouth Atlas. So much of my work has already been done. The scandal is that these attacks on Wenberg have received virtually no publicity. That's the scandal. Just to briefly orient the listeners to what we're talking about, Dr. Wenberg has assembled some statistics that he gets from the federal government, from Medicare. This is his database. And the statistics that he's interested in are statistics on people who have died. He looks at these people who have died, and for each person, there is data. There's the age of death. There's the cause of death. There is the location of the death, the name of the hospital where the person died. There's the gender of the person and the race of the person. So he has this data, this profile of the person who died. And he also has data on how much that person cost for their medical care. This is Medicare cost. It does not include other sources.
So they'll be over 65.
These are all people over 65. In fact, the people he's looking at are people who died from age 67 to 100, because what he does is he focuses on the last 2 years of life and says, okay, what was spent on this person? And adds everything, hospital costs, physician costs, medication costs, x-ray costs, all kinds of tests, all that stuff. Then maps this over the country. For the purpose of the mapping, the country is divided into 306 what he terms hospital referral regions. And these are regions with at least one major hospital center which does cardiac surgery and neurosurgery. So it has one major medical center at least. And it's a hospital referral region because it's a place where you can refer patients to one of these medical centers, pure and simple. So he has 306 of these regions, and he has all this data. And what he starts doing is mapping who is dying, what are they dying from, and how much did it cost to treat them before they died. Now, the results of his research are a series of correlations. The correlations that he finds is that some areas of the country characteristically, by a large area, spend more than other areas of the country for the average patient. And these are combined data. And he questions, why are some areas spending more than others? Could it be that they have more difficult patients? Could it be that they have more expensive the cost of living in their area. Why are they spending so much and other areas spending less? And he also asked the question, are they getting better results for all the money they're spending? And he's talking about levels of difference of at least twice. Some areas are spending twice as much as others, or even more, in terms of large areas. And some small areas are spending even more. So there are outliers on both ends, high spenders and low spenders. And what he purports to show is that the high spenders don't get any additional bang for the buck. They get the same results as the low spenders. That is to say, on measures of quality of care, that they all get about the same. So then he asks the question, why are we spending so much? And Peter Ortsock has taken this data and has used it to trumpet the idea that we could save $700 billion a year in the United States if we just cut down the cost in the areas that are using more money and match them up with the level of care provided for the areas that are using less money. That's the bottom line of this whole debate. And President Obama has jumped on the bandwagon. In fact, he is using this supposed cost saving as his main source of income, of saving, in order to justify expanding coverage to the 40 million or so people who don't have coverage now. This is the financial basis of his plan. He also has tax increases for the wealthy, but this is the core of it. This savings by withholding care in areas that appear to be providing too much. And I can say later why this study is totally incompetent and why the people who will suffer the most are the poorest and the most socially isolated people. Because those are the areas that are getting the more of the spending, and I can explain why they're getting more of the spending too, when I get a little more time later in the show.
Thank you, and I want to point out Dr. Rozinski, Ned, our friend here. I think I'm not sure I said this before. Who's a practicing physician in Baltimore? He has many specialties. One of them is emergency room medicine, and so forth and so on. But
actually, this time psychiatry.
So, thank you. Yeah. Okay. That's what I meant. He has a man of many areas of expertise, but one of them was a study of Baltimore. You can find it on EIR on LaRouchePub.com for January 2006 in terms of the point he's going to relate to. But let's switch right away and do a close-in zoom at what he's just said, that there's certain areas of the country, even supposing this Nazi doctor Wenberg and some other characters, I think there's a man named Fisher up in New Hampshire who've been doing this for years, didn't lie about data itself. There are reasons why care costs a certain amount from different parts of the country. One of them that was publicized by the New Yorker magazine that this Dartmouth study group did was in the border area between Mexico and the United States in the state of Texas in the Rio Grande Valley called McAllen as a hospital referral area. And Keisha, you've toured the state of Texas. You've been organizing there. You've been there, especially in Austin. I understand your legislature only meets every 2 years. And you kicked up a storm in the state capitol about the overall situation we're in. But can you say something about this?
Absolutely. Well, I'll start with the fact that, you know, going back to 2007, when LaRouche made clear in his warnings in July of 2007 that the entire financial monetary system was on the point of disintegration, and the economic policies that had been taken up from the point of 2007 to the period that we're in now have been a complete disaster. You have to look at where we're at from that standpoint, because this is the way that we're going to defeat this, as we've exposed it, Nazi healthcare policy. And I'll tell you, from McAllen, Texas, down through the Rio Grande, the border area, we've had a lot of activity there, especially going back to Mr. LaRouche's proposal in 2007 for what he called the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. And as we toured the areas, what we found was a situation that is similar to what you're finding throughout the nation, where the level of unemployment is beyond belief, where the breakdown of the physical economy, the breakdown of socioeconomic status, meaning that people's productive output in these areas, especially in McAllen and around the El Paso border areas of Texas, which are predominantly Hispanic population, you're finding a real breakdown in not only the physical economy and unemployment status, but in you're finding a breakdown in mortality and death rates right now because of the fact that there's not adequate health care and infrastructure there. And so for the president to target this area, this really goes to show that his policy is absolutely in line with what Hitler did in 1939, because the policy is that there are lives unfit or unworthy of life. And as you see that as the physical economy breaks down and you have a situation right now where the basis of economic so-called stability and revenue is coming, especially you can use locations such as McAllen and see where, for instance, the drug trafficking, the money laundering operations are very key there, and that there is no outlook on a long-term productivity and projection of life, especially in the elderly population. And it's with this Dartmouth study and what Dr. Radzinski wrote about Dr. Winberg and his policies for end-of-life care, the population in the McAllen area, you know, you have a lot of elderly population. You also have, as the economy continues to disintegrate, you're going to have a situation where more and more people are unemployed. Therefore, more and more people, I was looking at some statistics on this myself, where they're reporting the increase in the number of people that are now dependent on Medicaid, Medicare assistance. And so Obama's policy right now says that we have to be cost effective, that taking care of the elderly and taking care of the poor and actually defending the general welfare of the nation is too costly to the nation. And this is the same type of policy that Hitler had, and this is why we are out to stop it now. But the only way that we're going to stop this is that we have to change the axioms of thinking in the population for the past 40 years, and the axioms of thinking in the institutions of governments with the policymakers that have been going along with the incompetency in economic policies. And so I'll start with that, because I'll tell you with that, this our fight right now has waged a very strong uproar in the population, a very fighting spirit that we're seeing right now. And from the youth movement and what we're doing right now on the grounds 6 days a week in the streets, we can see this from a firsthand experience that throughout history, going back to the foundation of the nation and the American Revolution and so forth, we've never been a nation that sat back and watched as fascism, you know, reared its ugly head. We've always stood and fought. And I think that's what you're getting right now, most definitely, because the population most definitely can smell a rat with this healthcare policy.
Yeah, one thing you may know, but in the 90s, the geographic area in which McAllen is located, all the way upriver at El Paso and the rest, was called the hepatitis belt by public health workers there, mm-hmm. because of the poverty conditions 10, 15 years ago, before the Maquiladora policy and before the North American Free Trade Association was implemented in 1994. So already that was underway. So now you have a situation of complete collapse, practically, from what
right, and you have it as one right now, one of the highest rates of swine flu finding, as that continues to increase right now. So we're finding more and more people throughout the United States. I think the last report we put out is well over 1 million people have now been called for have been deemed infected with the swine flu. And so you're seeing that, especially in very desolate in areas such as McAllen, El Paso, and so forth. I know we've written quite a few articles or reports, you know, detailing this and where there's been an increase in the death rates and the number of people, you know, that have been infected with these various types of diseases because of the lack of care.
Now, one thing, since I may or may not have mentioned to our listeners today, that within 10 minutes, Keisha, you have to leave to go to another function. There are a lot of meetings, and even on the topic of healthcare right now, all around the country.
Yes, absolutely.
But do you want to say, before Ned continues on this, certain points about this, but you mentioned intervening in the uproar in the population because people smell a rat. Do you want to differentiate more? You've also been making a point of bringing, let's call it optimism, bringing a sense of solution to all this. Have you been on campuses a lot or mostly in the streets to some of the young people, or differentiating among some of the older legislators? What does it look like?
Everywhere. Okay. I'll tell you, right before I got on this show, I just came back from a deployment. So I was on the radio. I was running into the office here. And, you know, I went out, and the first person that came up to the table said, yes, we have to defeat this. We have to defeat this policy because, you know, right now civilization depends on whether or not we win this fight. And this person, you have people like this all over the place, that they know that right now, as the economic crisis continues to worsen, that there is no competency and leadership in sight except for what LaRouche PAC and the LaRouche Youth Movement is providing. And so they want it most, you know, you have people who are coming up, marching up to our political tables, marching up to our organizers, ready to fight. And sorry.
Probably calling you right now to say, where can I go?
Yes. And, you know, today I had one gentleman just come up. He already had his check ready for $250. So people are ready. People are ready to fight beyond what they think they can do right now. And I think what's important to communicate to the population is that not only is LaRouche adamant about defeating this Nazi healthcare policy, but he's adamant about getting the population to understand that the fight at hand is much bigger. The fight at hand right now is, can we actually emerge with the quality of leadership that is going to provide the necessary solutions to dealing with this crisis? That we're talking about a breakdown of the entire world financial system, and that everything that people have been taught to believe in their axioms of economics, of history, and has been completely flawed, and that we have to go back to a principle which is that which was embedded in our foundations of the Constitution and our nation, that the solution to dealing with this crisis right now is that we're going to have to take courage from those great leaders like Franklin Roosevelt. We're going to have to take courage from Abraham Lincoln and realize that the principles of the general welfare that come that are embedded in our Constitution and Declaration of Independence are the key to dealing with this crisis right now. Because as you have people who come to believe that there are lives unworthy of life, or that you can actually promote a policy that does not act in the interest of the development, the creative development of your citizens and your population, that is something that should really get under the skins of the population. And I think right now, as the LaRouche Youth Movement continues not only to go out onto the street and defeat this healthcare policy, because it's a must right now, if civilization is going to survive, we cannot allow a Nazi policy to rear itself in the United States or anywhere else. But I think the important thing to understand is that we actually have to bring a sense of optimism, and that's what we're fighting to do right now, to the population by understanding that what we need right now is we need a complete cultural renewing and breakthrough, a renaissance of real scientific ideas, of real creative output, because the policies that are being pushed right now have in view that there is no creative potential in human beings, that they're dispensable and they're nothing more than a bunch of herded cattle or animals. And so we can use the counting measures and cost-effective measures to figure out where we're going to cut the lives of human beings to save money, instead of thinking, well, what do we need to do right now to improve the conditions of life? To say that what is necessary right now is that we help to develop every single human being by creating the jobs and infrastructure which is needed to make citizens productive again, by creating a culture which is embedded in classical science and classical art. And so as many people hear Mr. LaRouche continue to develop the idea of what his youth movement is doing and basement projects, and then many people have gone onto our website and saw a lot of the activity coming out of the youth movement, the video productions that we're making, that is key to the type of change in the thinking of the culture that which is needed right now. And I think what people should take as inspiration in our fight, as, you know, the crisis requires more and more people to get involved, as more and more people start to become a bit afeared by the reality of what's happening, that they can overcome their fears by realizing that we have a history of great creative breakthroughs, that creative breakthroughs in science and culture that we can look back on again. And the work that the LaRouche Youth Movement is doing right now on the scientific breakthroughs and on classical music is key to actually giving the population that courage right now. And so I'd say most definitely go beyond what you think you can do as the listeners are listening to this show, and get involved in the fight with us, and also realize that the LaRouche Youth Movement right now is actually providing the leadership and the key solutions to dealing with this crisis.
Well, that's great, and we just did seem to reach the time in which you have to go. And Keisha, I really appreciate you being on here to speak directly from Texas. It's also, you're part of the world that at one point was building up the infrastructure of the country. I think it had the famous Waco Veterans Affairs hospital system. Mm-hmm. In the last 100 years, I think Texas was one area that had to defeat yellow fever. Everywhere did, but you know what I mean. There were all right. of these advances. So I'll refer people to just what you said. Go on LaRouchePac.com, LaRouchePac.com. You'll find video features and daily clips, one of which is on the Franklin Delano Roosevelt buildup of public health. And also you'll find the summary of LaRouche's response when a week ago President Obama says, well, if anyone can tell me if there's anything else to be done about the health crisis emergency, let him say. And LaRouche said, yes, end these health maintenance organizations, go for a Franklin Roosevelt-style build-up, the Hill-Burton system, as it used to be called. So I guess you've said your last word, but if you want to motivate anything else again, I thank you for spending the time.
Thank you very much. I'll just say, once again, you reminded people to go to the website, and I thank you for having me on. And that Mr. LaRouche, I know you'll say this once again, we are mobilizing right now for Mr. LaRouche's webcast, which is going to give people the marching orders to take this fight on August the 1st.
That's right, on LaRouchePac.com. Thank you, and we'll talk to you again. Thanks very much.
Thank
Keisha
you.
Rogers in Houston, Texas. So We'll come back around to Ned. Dr. Rosinski here with us because I was mentioning defeating what Mr. LaRouche and also, you know, Representative John Conyers, Ned, gave a press conference yesterday in Washington, D.C. and said, why have these private insurance companies continue to do this rake off of what's happening in the country? You know, the Dartmouth Healthcare Atlas project that Ned is describing and has completely put down comes out of this Dartmouth College in New Hampshire study institute of what amounts to Nazi doctors, but its major funders for years, you can check it out on the internet, are Aetna Insurance, United Healthcare, the biggest managed healthcare company by revenue in the United States, and WellPoint. They're all among the top five, and they're the ones that are coming up with these arguments saying there are places that are spending too much, cut them back. So, Ned, if you can continue on this expose of the crazy basis of making this kind of assertion that you were just saying that Orzog is insisting on.
Yeah, I think first I want to pick up on something that Keisha was talking about. I just want to push it one step further. When you talk about the constitution of this country and the history of our economy, in order to explain why we have had historically really the best economy in the world, the most productive economy with ups and downs, but our economy looks like no other. The reason is because it was founded on the idea of progress as a conception, but also in a practical sense. The history of this country is a history of what you would call great projects. We have what you would refer to as a project economy orientation. In the early years, there was the Transcontinental Railroad. There was rural electrification. There was the buildup of the industrial base in the Midwest. There were great projects. FDR exemplified this also in terms of great projects. The most recent and probably the greatest one of all was the space program, Kennedy's program. These projects have several functions, and they are indispensable to the United States American system of economy. We need these projects. This is how we have survived as an economic power and also as an ideological pro-progress population. We've survived on the basis of these great projects. The great projects mobilize the population to do things which are practical, to develop science, develop industries, to get training for kids to go into these fields because they are interested. But it also not only mobilizes the conscience of the country in terms of the idea of progress, and that man can perfect himself. But it also provides what are called spin-offs into the rest of the economy. One good science driver, one good great project, like the manned space exploration, enlivens the entire economy in economic terms, not just in ideological terms. There are spin-offs from these projects, like with putting the man on the moon. We have enormous computer development, material science, understanding of hydrodynamic flows and aerodynamics and fluid dynamics. These things are all basic science and applied science projects that are enormously expensive. But when applied to the general economy, pay back anywhere from 2 to 10-fold. And this was documented very clearly by the NASA organization itself in a magazine called Spinoffs, where they documented thousands and thousands of these spinoffs. The economy was basically feeding on the space program. That's how you have to look at it.
Can you mention some of those medical ones because you do in your paper?
Yeah, the artificial ventricular assist device, which is keeping people alive now. You have to be able to coordinate the blood flow through these devices so that it gets a little bit of turbulence, but not too much. If it gets no turbulence, it'll clot. If it gets too much turbulence, it'll clot. But it has to have the right amount of turbulence. How do you control turbulence? This is a very advanced physical science problem. And who are the ones who are the best at controlling turbulence? The people who design airplane wings. And rockets. They understand the mathematics and the physics behind turbulence and controlling turbulence, organized rotational flows and that kind of thing. So So these are also very important basic science issues. Highly organized, self-organized turbulence in fluids is one of the most interesting concepts that physics has to deal with in terms of fluid flow and Riemannian mathematics applications to real physics. The effect of these great projects is to really enliven the population and push the economy forward. We had a similar kind of thing that was burgeoning in the area of nuclear energy, both with fission and particularly with a kind of nuclear energy called fusion, which is the conversion of hydrogen into enormous amounts of energy. Hydrogen becomes deuterium, and there are several different variants. The basic science for that is that you have to contain these quantities of hydrogen at very high temperatures and very small and very high densities. And the physics of that involves lasers and magnetic bottles, configurations, that kind of thing. This is technical stuff, but it is important feeder into basic science and, of course, an important feeder into energy production. We would have enormous amounts of energy. We could desalinate water very cheaply and green the deserts. There would be no shortage of water, and certainly there would be no shortage of oil because it would replace oil. So the control of commodities by international speculators and financiers would disappear. And that's one of the major reasons for the attacks on nuclear energy, both fusion and fission. Well, what happened after Kennedy was assassinated was the funding for these programs was cut way back. Yes, we still have a little space program, and we still have a little fusion program, but they're not producing very much. And it's not capturing the imagination of the population. So we cut off the major science drivers in the 60s, 1960s. And progressively through Nixon. These were cut off. We've had some presidents that were somewhat better than others, some presidents that are somewhat worse than others, but nobody has actually revitalized these projects. At this point, the economy is suffering tremendously from the lack of such projects. So when you get into the debate about what to do about healthcare, because healthcare is, quote, expensive, healthcare has a high inflator. It's going up faster than other indices of inflation. People cannot afford health premiums. There are 40 million or more people who don't have health insurance. These are real problems. How do you solve those problems? Well, what I suggest people do is just take one giant step back and look at the entire economy, because healthcare is part of our economy. Our economy is now in shambles because of the destruction of our science drivers, number one. Number two, some other technical issues, a tax policy which promotes exportation of industrial capacity to areas with cheap labor, which has been widely publicized. Something less publicized is that the speculative aspects of banking has been allowed to merge into the merchant aspects of banking. Glass-Steagall, which was a major revolution under Roosevelt, has been systematically dismantled, which is destroying our banking apparatus and creating enormous investment into derivatives and other kinds of useless speculation, which is destroying the economy like a giant leech. So there are other things going wrong with the economy. However, if you don't fix all these things and get an overview of how the economy is falling apart, if you just limit your field of vision to healthcare, you cannot possibly solve the problem. If we had a healthy economy, we would not have this kind of problem with healthcare payment. The healthcare problem is that we don't have the rest of the economy. We don't have the spin-offs from the NASA project, for instance. So we don't have a feeder from other sectors of the economy. Plus, the overall economy destruction that's going on now has decimated state health budgets, federal budgets, and individuals' pockets, their own budgets, so that healthcare, like everything else, is becoming more expensive. Any one sector of the economy that attempts to do a good job in this context, such as healthcare, will appear to be more inflated because it's trying to do it on its own while everything else falls apart. That is the problem. Healthcare is attempting to maintain high standards in a field in which the idea of progress is still very much alive, in which we are still discovering new ways of curing horrible diseases and extending life and bettering life. And there is the one area at this time that still embodies the idea of progress in the United States. It's only in healthcare. I know it sounds like a blanket statement, but I really think that's true. It used to be space program and a few other things and healthcare, and now it's just healthcare.
In other words, you're talking about the general decent public opinion that's inclined toward thinking, gee, we could find a way to solve this disease or find a way to cure that or repair this.
Right. So there wouldn't be a problem if the economy were healthy. And the way you get into the incompetent kind of studies that we're talking about with Wenberg is you start off with an even larger incompetence, which is to narrow your focus to just healthcare. If you narrow your focus to just healthcare, there is no way out. Healthcare cannot pay for itself. The entire economy has to support these advanced scientific developments. All right? So then what happens? Well, the natural thing to do is look around and say, okay, well, we can't pay for healthcare now. What can we cut and still survive? How can we pay for this? And in fact, how can we get more people insurance? So people look around, finding what they can cut, how they can save, how they can be more efficient. And these people with some good motivation, seeing, is there anything we're wasting? But that's the environment that we get thrust into when we look at healthcare in isolation. Then it is in this environment, trying to find something to save without killing people off. Because most people don't want to kill people off. That's not part of our tradition. In this environment, looking desperately for something to save, then you have the introduction of the Wenberg studies. Now, these Wenberg studies have been around for decades. They have not been very well widely publicized because of severe criticisms of the studies that have come about, as I mentioned earlier today. But recently, they've been trumpeted by Peter Ortzag at the Office of Management and Budget, who's now head of Obama's White House budget office. And then Obama himself has come in on it. And so all of a sudden, it's in all the newspapers, and it bears a very strong, hard look. What is this Wenberg apparatus all about? And it looks good when you first look at the surface of it, because Wenberg says there is spending that does not need to be done. Parts of the country are spending more than other parts, and they're getting the same results. It sounds great. It's a way to cut things without killing people. That's the big argument for Wenberg. We can make these cuts, reduce the efficiency, and nobody will suffer. However, once you scratch the surface, you find it is exactly the opposite. And that is a horror story. And that's what I just want to indicate a little bit of here.
Okay, the horror story.
The horror story is that the areas of highest spending are generally urban. They are East Coast and Southern California, West Coast, and some of the inner cities in the middle of the country. They are the concentrations of the population, and they are where the poor are living. Pure and simple. The reason that these areas are spending more is because people there are poorer. Now, Wenberg says, well, you know, you look at his statistics are, you look at how much was spent for 2 years before somebody died, and some areas spend more and some areas spend less, but guess what? They all died. So therefore, it wasn't very helpful that they spent more or spent less. However, this is a backwards way of doing a scientific study. The real way to do a scientific study would be to take a cohort of patients who are all about the same level of sickness and follow them going forward. It's called a prospective study. And some of the patients might get certain treatments, some of the patients might get other treatments, and you see who does better. That's typically the way scientific research is done in the healthcare industry, prospectively. You try to limit the number of variables so that you can, if there is a difference, you can pin it on something. The golden standard would be only one variable, and hopefully a variable that the patients and the doctors who are observing them are not even aware of who has what until the end. However, in this particular case, you have quite a complicated story. We can't ethically deny treatment to some people and give treatment to other people. It's a complicated situation, but it can be done. However, the way Wenberg does it, which is looking at everybody who died, in fact, he actually makes a statement in his atlas that all these people, 2 years before they died, they all had precisely the identical prognosis because they all died in 2 years. Well, if you were a doctor 2 years before that, you certainly would not make that judgment because some people die unexpectedly. Medical science is not an exact science. You can't tell in advance sometimes how long it will take somebody to die because you may be able to do interventions which will prolong their life or even cure them. So the chronic diseases are not by any means all relentless, leading inevitably to death within a certain period of time. So to assume that's the case is quite dangerous because you end up with that conclusion. In fact, you could actually extend it a little bit further to the point of ridiculous situation and say the patients who received no treatment, they also probably would have died within 2 years. They probably would have died a little quicker, as a matter of fact. and we would have saved a lot of money. And all, since all the patients had the same prognosis and they all died, why don't we just not treat anybody for the last 2 years? That would be ideal. We'd have the lowest cost possible. We'd save a lot of money because a lot of the Medicare money goes to those last 2 years because people become more expensive to treat as they get sicker and sicker. That's the logical conclusion. Now, on the issue of poverty, this bears particular emphasis because it's so ironic that President Obama was elected. He's our first black president. Many black people voted for him. He seemed to be a man of the people. He seemed to be a man who would be against the entrenched interests and would have the interest of the population at heart. And yet he's proposing a health plan which predominantly punishes the poor, socially isolated, helpless people. I don't know if he's aware of it. My guess is that he's not, but that he's listening to what Peter Ortzog is saying, who's leading him down this horrible path. Now, how do I know what I just said is true? Well, first of all, you look at the statistics, and I'm just going to give you some broad brushstrokes of this. The ideal areas that Winberg has identified are the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and the Intermountain Healthcare group of facilities around Salt Lake City, Utah. These areas are predominantly white. They're predominantly they're employed. The level of poverty is quite low, and people who have visited these places have said and written that at least half of the difference between that kind of place, like Mayo Clinic, and a typical major hospital center like New York University Medical Center in Manhattan, in New York City, is at least 50% of the difference in the cost is socioeconomic. At least. That is to say, it takes more to treat people who are poor in New York City than it does to treat people who are better off in Rochester, Minnesota, or Salt Lake City, Utah. Why is that the case? It is the case because these are people who have probably had less health care before they come to the attention of a doctor during the course of their lives. Remember, we're talking about people who are on Medicare. So these are people in the retirement age, over 65, actually over 67 in these studies. So these people in poor areas have not had good health care all their lives. They may not have good diets. They may not be living in healthy conditions. But predominantly, what seems to really be the factor is that they come from society, subsections of a society, without a lot of social supports. And this seems to be the crucial factor, social supports.
So you mean, so in facing discharge for having a treatment for something, they can go back to a household where they may not be able to do well.
Yeah. So, and you see this at all levels of the healthcare, that the level of social support and basically socioeconomic status is very important in determining the intensity of the healthcare that you're going to provide people. Let me explain that a little bit. Suppose you have somebody who has a heart attack or a stroke. They both cases they would have to be hospitalized. There's no question. They can't be treated at a lower level of care, such as outpatient. However, after they're stabilized, they may be discharged back to their home with a follow-up visit, maybe within a week. At the follow-up visit, the main effort of the physician will be to try to prevent a repeat episode of the stroke or the heart attack. And one of the ways that it's very important to do that would be to control for risk factors that can cause strokes and heart attacks, such as high blood pressure, high blood sugar, overweight, and other kinds of risk factors. Now, these risk factors are controlled by medications and by lifestyle. So if a patient comes back a week later from having had one of these heart attacks or strokes, comes back after discharge to the doctor's outpatient office, and the patient is doing well, patient is taking medications as prescribed, the patient is monitoring their blood sugar, the patient is on the right diet, the patient is doing the right exercise, a family member is with them, which following over everything, and the indices, the indications are that the blood pressure is okay, the blood sugar is okay, diet is okay, then the patient is basically in a safe environment and the outpatient care can be continued with another visit, say, in a month or two. However, if the patient comes back and the patient has not been taking their medications because there's nobody at home to ensure that they are, or the patient is not eating the right diet, or the patient doesn't even come back because there's nobody to ensure that the patient come back, or the family is so fractured that nobody's taking responsibility. If the patient is living in a chaotic environment, in other words, then the patient is much more at risk for a relapse or recurrent of the of the initial event, the heart attack or the stroke. So what does the doctor do? The doctor sees the patient's in trouble. The doctor will not say come back in 3 months or 1 month. The doctor may say come back in 2 weeks or 1 week. I have to monitor you more closely. If the doctor sees the patient frequently enough, they may be able to get the blood pressure in the right range. They may be able to get the blood sugar in the right range. But it's going to take a lot more work to do it, a lot more visits. The patient may need to go to a nursing home. They may need to have home health care. So if the doctor works a lot to do it, the doctor can get the patient into the right ballpark in terms of risk factors. But it requires more work, more doctor visits, more specialty care. And so this appears to be the consensus of what's going on in poor areas, to make it simple, is that more intensive care is required to get the same results. Now, what Wenberg finds again and again is that the areas that use more resources get the same results or get a little bit worse than the other areas, which is what you'd expect, because you're not going to save everybody from these kinds of chaotic environments. Now, it's very important to understand that Wenberg does not use socioeconomic variables in his data. The Atlas does not contain income data. It's blind. It doesn't contain data regarding family structure. So that questions like ever married or currently married are not in there. Other studies have shown that those statistics are very strongly correlated with health outcome and with health resource utilization. So why is Wenberg avoiding these factors? This is the problem with the Wenberg Atlas. It doesn't look at socioeconomic status. When you start looking at socioeconomic status, what you see is it explains the great majority of the difference in healthcare utilization in these last 2 years of life. That's the bottom line.
So, Ned, let me ask you one thing. Yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt your narrative, but if I've looked at this, I recommend people do look at the Atlas he's talking about. You can find it on any search engine by putting in Dartmouth Healthcare Atlas, and you can click on a state. So in a way, in reverse, it actually maps by showing higher costs per Medicare person, where you might want to target in a rebuilding effort, where you would have employment projects and upgrade the general economic base of that region, the cross-border area with Mexico, the inner cities, the East Coast, Southern California.
So I'll explain a little bit more why I feel so strong that this is the case, but I do want to point out the implication of this, which is if Obama is given the authority to do so and starts cutting back, what they want to do is they want to cap healthcare utilization payments and resources in the areas that are using them the most until they come down to the average expense of healthcare areas that are using them the least. They want to bring New York City, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., down to the level of Salt Lake City, Utah. Who is that going to hurt? Who is it going to kill? He's not saying I want to kill people. But I want to tell you, just like the Nazis, they never said they wanted to kill the Jews. It was you know, the final solution. A lot of this was hidden from the population. They never said they're going to kill off the useless leaders. These were all done by euphemisms. Euphemisms. The doctors provided the information on who was sick in each hospital and was so-called chronically sick. They were giving the information in euphemisms. It was all hidden from the population. So that's not that different here. It's all being hidden. And there was an earlier study by the Wenberg Group in 2003, which did look in a limited sense at income for three disease states only, which were colon cancer, heart attacks, and hip fractures. They did look at the income, but they looked at the income in a smoothed-out, distributed fashion where you couldn't see where the poor people were because they did it on the basis of zip code. Let me give you an example of this. Baltimore City has 38 zip codes. I did a study of Baltimore City on income within those zip codes and death rates, and I found nothing. But then I did a second study using census tracts. And there are 201 census tracts. And then the numbers bounced out. There I saw it. Twice the risk of death, depending on the extremes of income. That was the difference. Twice the risk. Age-adjusted. Race-adjusted. The poor people were dying more easily, faster, and losing more years of their life. You walk around any major city, and you will walk from poor neighborhoods to rich neighborhoods within 3 or 4 blocks where they meet. The only way you can get enough resolution, enough sharpness of vision, to be able to see what's going on in the poor neighborhoods as opposed to the rich neighborhoods is to do a very sharply detailed study. This is not what the Wenberg study did back in 2003. And even though they didn't do that, they still found a trend that poorer people seem to use more resources. They also found a small trend that the very wealthy seem to use more resources. It was like a U-shaped curve, but not as much. But just think, if you have a poor neighborhood next to a rich neighborhood, and you take the whole thing and average the income, which is what Wenberg did for each of those patients, you end up with a middle income. And lo and behold, there's not very much correlation between that and the spending differentials across the country. So on the basis of that limited study, Wenberg apparently felt he no longer needed to do that for the large, massive atlas, and simply ignored the problem and footnoted the other study. So we're dealing with hand-waving. We're dealing with sophisticated statisticians who not really know better, but are highly motivated to get certain results. And we're dealing now with a political climate in which this stuff has been trumpeted so much that it's becoming a virtual brick wall to get through. But I will tell you that there is grumbling. There was a New York Times article June 9th or so, June 7th, that talked about the McCallum study and noted that Senator John Kerry in Massachusetts was complaining about ironing out all the expenditures across the country, saying that in his state, it was a state where they were making major medical breakthroughs. I mean, think about Harvard and all the associated hospitals and the other medical schools in Boston and other areas up there. And that they were training the best doctors in the country, which is true. And therefore, this may be a little more expensive. So here's John Kerry saying, hey, put on the brakes. What are you doing? At least recognizing that everything is not the same in every state. He did not mention the issue about poor people, maybe because he's not aware of it. But he will be. We'll make sure of that. We're going to distribute this throughout Congress, and we're going to make sure that everybody knows what they are doing. It's going to be none of this defense, as in Nuremberg. I didn't know. They know. They will know. And just a word about McCallum. Now, McCallum, why McCallum? McCallum was actually identified in the Wenberg Atlas as the highest spender.
Maybe $15,000 a year per person.
It was higher than any other county. And it's called Hidalgo County, that McCallum, the town, is located in. The highest spender in the country. So a Harvard surgeon went down there to investigate what was going on and canvassed the area. And first, in his report that was published in the New Yorker magazine on June 1st, time to coincide with the Obama thrust, pointed out that said that the population demographics are essentially the same in McAllister and McCallum and in El Paso. It turns out it's not true. You just look at how many people are needing Medicaid to pay for their Medicare copayments, which is all part of the Medicare data, and you'll see that it's 46% in McCallum and 48% in McCallum and 36% in El Paso. And the third city that was compared was Grand Junction, Colorado, which is pointed out as a great example of a low cost area, 98% white, 11% needed the assistance for their Medicare from Medicaid. In the other two cities that I mentioned are 26% Hispanic. These are completely different populations. And when this was actually thoroughly reviewed by Daniel Gilden, which is published on the web, what he found was that the population of McCallum was actually much sicker than El Paso, and when you looked at it on the basis of per patient cost, was almost identical with Grand Junction, Colorado, if you match up patients who are equally ill. That's all I have time for right now, but this is a long story. I encourage people to look at what we're publishing because the details really show you where the devil is.
Thank you very much. And we are going to defeat this devil, as Ned said, and that will be on our website where you're seeing us now or listening afterwards on laruchepub.com by Dr. Ned Rosinski, and it will be posted within a few hours. And you can get all the details in this paper. Finally, in closing, and this is July 26, 2009, this is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm thanking Dr. Ned Rosinski for being with us, and earlier, Keisha Rogers. I just want to close with a personal message to tell our listeners that tomorrow, Sunday, which is, this is July 25th, tomorrow's July 26th, in Houston, Texas, is a gathering of friends and family for the memory and the celebration of the life of Susan Schlanger. There is a tribute to her at that time. 3 weeks ago, she passed away after a valiant fight against cancer for some 30 months. And Susan Schlanger, who is a great patriot, she is immortal in what she has done. She is was Harley Schlanger's wife, a great colleague of Keisha Rogers and all others, especially of the LaRouche Youth Movement and the LaRouche Political Activity Center based in Texas. She will be with us. We extend to Keisha, to Harley, and to everyone in Texas and around the world our sympathy. I know I speak for everyone here and those listening, and keep her in your hearts tomorrow and her friends and family. So thank you, everyone. And August 1st, be sure at 1 p.m. to hear the Lyndon LaRouche International webcast, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on laruchepac.com. Thank you, everyone.